Our main speaker tonight is Debbie.
Hi, everybody. I'm Debbie Davis, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's really a treat to be here. I had the privilege of speaking here 8 years ago, so it's nice to be invited back. Nice to be invited back anywhere, huh? But I do come from California, so it isn't like I'm just around the corner. So again, thank you, Nye, for the invitation. I appreciate that. And I want to welcome our new friends that identified in their first 90 days. I hope that you find here what many of us have found. And my story tonight is just to share with you my experience, strength, and hope. A little bit of the adventures before and after Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's given me a life that I didn't even know existed. And if it did exist, what would I ever do to be able to experience this? Not just the outside things that I've gotten to do, but it's the inside and the character and the person that I've gotten to become. And that I didn't know that was even possible or even something I was interested in. But my journey here in Alcoholics Anonymous began a while ago, and it came after my second relapse. I had been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous 10 months before that. And when I was first here, of course, in my way, I found all the differences, because I don't want to be one of you. I went to one AA meeting a month. I was required to go to that many, and I wasn't going to go to two and look like you're joining AA or anything like that in a month. So I went to that one, and I got that paper signed, but 7 months of being dry, that sobriety, you know, phase, I drank again, no surprise. But there was a surprise. The drinking wasn't as I had recalled it to be. I had remembered the fun and the, you know, party and the fantasy world, and it's all going on. And this was a week and a half that was a dark in and out of a blackout. And it was different. But there was no surprise that I took that first drink, because I had no defense. I had developed no relationship with a higher power. I didn't do anything here except simply not drink and sit in meetings now and then. And if you'd asked me, are you a member of AA or do you go to AA? I'd say, oh, yeah. But I wouldn't have had a clue really what that question was about, what that really meant. And so I had this attitude that I had learned my lesson, and I ramped my meetings up from one a month to one a week. And so that sounds like a lot of meetings to me when you don't want to do anything here. So, you know, that really going all the time. And finally the day came when I had that last relapse. And it wasn't any big rip-roaring, bank-robbing, getaway car kind of ish deal at all. It was more of like one of those balloons that when you let the air out, it just kind of goes, you know, one of those. It wasn't any big deal. But the shift happened. The shift from all the information up here, the yakety-yak, the information, and the shift of the two-foot drop to where I finally, for me, admitted to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And as I said, it wasn't any big deal, but it was the thing that kicked me off the fence of reservation and indecision of whether or not I was an alcoholic. And it was like I emotionally and spiritually flatlined. And between that breath and the next one, the thought came into my mind, and I know it was from a power greater than myself, that those people in AA seem to know what to do. And in a way, that old person died and a new one started, a new heartbeat. Now, I didn't all of a sudden just run in the doors and I'm going to do everything different kind of attitude, but there was a shift in thinking. We talk about a psychic change. I don't remember which page it is on right now, but three times it talks about the psychic change. And all I can look at that and say in my story was a psychic change happened that day. Because the reference is that at one point they could not stop drinking or could not do anything about their life, and something, this phenomenon happens, and that person is now this person. How does that happen other than it wasn't anything I did to create that? It wasn't a goal I was shooting for. It was an experience that happened. And so that was a Saturday, and on Sunday, I was sober all day, and I went to that weekly meeting I'd been going to. Now, the way I went to meetings is I walked in when it started, I left when it was over, got her done, you know, chalk that off. And so I decided to go early. I went 20 minutes early, and that was kind of like going like the day before, you know, compared to what I'd been doing. And I'm thinking, who goes this early, right? Well, y'all know who goes that early because you're all here that early. I didn't think about anything like that because all I was doing was sobriety out of convenience and nothing more. It wasn't commitment by a long shot. And so I went early and found that the old timers, the long timers are there. And it was, they're there early so goofy people like me can ask questions. And the next thing I did was very out of character, because when you're self-righteous and miss know-it-all, you don't ask questions. You don't know anything, but you still don't ask questions. And I asked a question. And I said, what do you do to stay sober? And that was the end of the question. As important as that question was, and that was my way of asking for help, I think what was as important, if not more important, and it still is today, is how I listened to the answer. Because I had to listen to their answer without conditions. I had to listen to their answer without negotiation. I had to listen to it without, in my mind, dumbing it down to what I felt like doing, which would have been nothing. Okay? And therefore, I'm not going to change or do anything different. I'm just going to be what I am now. So why bother their time without any action that I'm willing to put behind it? I still have to ask questions that way. It's not about negotiating, it's about stepping it up, not dumbing it down. And that's in every area of my life, that I need to keep stepping it up and keep going to that next level for me. And they knew, because they'd seen me dancing around these rooms here for 10 months, they knew I finally meant business. And they began to share with me what they did, not what they heard Uncle Joe did or what they read in some magazine. This is what we did. Maybe we want to give it a try. And they said, first and foremost, and I still believe all of these things today, they said, one day at a time, we don't take the first drink or anything, in my case, else, that affects me from the neck up. And I thought, well, you know, today's as good a day as any because I've been sober all day and I am ready to do this for the first time. And I took that day as my sobriety date. And that was February the 8th, 1976, which means I've been walking with you for over 40 years now. It doesn't seem that long because I feel when you live in the present, it's just another full day, and you get another one and another one. I mean, it's really kind of a mathematical phenomenon to be 40 years sober and 39 years old. I mean, it just, it's amazing how that works out, you know? So, I chronologically, okay, the truth be told, I got sober when I was 18 years old. I've never had a legal drink of alcohol. I hope I never do. But I also am not so arrogant to think that, hey, at 40, I got this deal. I have to do more to stay super grounded and connected, not less. And I love it. That's what keeps the fire going with inside of me, that glow on the inside of my heart. Is doing more, not less. And I took that first drink when I was 12 years old in a little town in South Dakota at the time. And I had no idea because I'd never seen alcohol impact anybody in any way. My parents were social drinkers. And when I took that drink, I was moved into a new world, and I wanted to be there all the time. The first drink gave me that glow on the inside, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm 12 years old, and nothing has ever done this for me. Oatmeal or anything, you know, has never made me feel like this. And when I got that second drink in, the shift again happened to me, because drink number one was please accept me, and drink number two was aren't you glad I'm here? You know, from there to there, how did I get there? Booze, and I want some more of it, and that just took me into that new world. And I just followed that with a passion. Everything in my life changed that night. Friends, money, where I went, everything shifted that night. I didn't realize that. It was just this automatic magnet. And I chased it as fast as I could, as hard as I could, in whatever way I could. I never tried to stop drinking. I never tried to regulate my drinking. I just tried to make it go further and faster. That's all I did. And at 17 and a half years old, my father, in the ABCs of how it works, says that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And if a human power could have, my father would have relieved my alcoholism. But he did not know what to do anymore. And when he sought professional advice with his hands thrown up in the air, they knew what he was dealing with. And they recommended he commit me to a program. And that's what he did. When I showed up the next time, 2 weeks later, sort of surfaced from wherever I was, he had a plan in action. And I was court committed to a little treatment center in Grand Forks, North Dakota at that time. And I would hear your stories and find all the differences, because I don't want to be one of you. I know I'm not too bright, but I do know that if I agreed to what you guys are saying, that I might be one. And I knew down here, that innermost self, I was not done drinking. And so I listened and I did the minimum to get by and get me off your radar. And I was sent to an all-women's halfway house in Minneapolis, and that's where I would go to that 7 months of being dry, drink again. 5 weeks later, and that last thing that I ever took was I got a letter in the mail from these friends in California that had sent me one joint. And I never liked pot. It's so slow, you know. And but it was there. That's what mattered. And I thought, well, I'll just keep it in case I need it sometime, you know. I was amazed I needed it the next day. It was just kind of, wow, what timing this was, right? Exactly. And that was the last thing to this moment that I've taken of my own hand to change the way that I feel and the way that I think. I didn't know that was going to be the last day. I had probably done something a little more exciting. It was just going to be a lie, a secret. Y'all didn't need to know about my business type thing. But you see, I'd acquired in that 10 months of not drinking a conscience. And I just couldn't live that. So that's how I got my sobriety date. Now, the rest of the things they shared with me is how I've kept it. Because just putting that plug in the jug, I proved, was not going to be sustainable. It wasn't going to keep me sober at all. And by just not drinking, I wasn't going to make any difference in my life either. There wasn't going to be any difference. So those 12 steps is what I needed to continue to do. And so they shared with me that we get a sponsor. And I've had the same sponsor for over 29 years. I've had two prior to her. I also sponsor women, and I think it's important because it can't stop with me and it can't stop with them. I will not sponsor a taker. You've got to be willing to pass this on, because I know what happens on the inside when you watch people change right in front of your eyes, when you watch the dead come alive, when you listen to that first inventory. When you get to see families reunited again, and we get to keep passing that on. And sponsorship has been a very key thing in my life. I talked about we go to a lot of meetings, and we get a home group. And I go to a minimum of 3 meetings a week. Now, I I've lived in four different parts of the country, and therefore I've had four different home groups as the result of that. So far, that's the only reason I've changed home groups. And when I moved to my last location now, I also realized I've had four different last names. And so every city had its own last name, you know, so it's kind of like how long I know people. And so I currently live in the Bay Area. I live in Concord, which is east of San Francisco, and I drive a half an hour. In my area, that is a long way. You know, here it might not be anything. And when I lived in Southern California, half an hour felt like around the block, you know, because it's such a lot of driving down there. But in my area, I live a half an hour from my home group, and it's an all-evening event. I leave at 6:15. I get home at 10:30. I'm there in over an hour before the meeting starts because I love to watch the meeting come alive like y'all do. And I'll have people in my area because they kind of put one of those pins in and they do a five-minute radius around there where they live, and that's fine. And they go to meetings in that local area, and that's great. But they'll say to me, why don't you, you know, I mean, isn't there something a little closer than, you know, driving to Dublin? And it's like, yeah, but I know what I get every single Monday night. I get a group like this that's alive, that's a three legacy, that has a heartbeat. If I lived in New York, you guys would have a brand new member here. You know, I would make this my home group. I have a sponsee who recently moved here, who a few months ago made this her home group, and I'm so excited about that because I knew what she was getting involved with. I love that kind of structure. That's what my group has too. Now, also with a home group, you know, as much as I love my home group and I'm always got a commitment in it, there's always been, you know, a couple people that I know they'd be happier in somebody else's home group. I don't know if you have that here. I never tell them that, but this is part of the joy of being in a home group, is that you get to change how you feel about people. I get to spiritually grow by staying, not by leaving. And it also gives me that opportunity to practice principles before personalities. There was a time in my home group where I was in Southern California, and there was I was going through a divorce, and there was me and the soon-to-be ex-he and the brand-new she. And, you know, when you're all part of the same home group, it can get kind of small, you know, because nobody got custody of the home group, okay? We all had to learn how to work with each other and share. And it was as important to them as it was to me. But what happened is that it was a great experience and a reminder that when I leave my car, personal issues stay there. And this is a safe sanctuary for every alcoholic, no matter who they are. And that it was very important for me that whatever personal feeling I had at the moment was not expressed, but that I worked the room even harder for those new faces and to be that active member in that room that night. And so a home group has taught me tremendously about so many tools on how to live in the world out there. They talked to me about taking the steps, and that by taking those steps one at a time, there wasn't a race, but don't draw it out. Have a momentum about it. And that each of those began to change who I was on the inside. And then when I got to 12, it didn't say start over. It said, girl, got your marching orders. Get out there and help someone else who doesn't know how to be different, how to live a sober way of life. And by walking people through this 12 steps, I get to take them again. I keep them fresh in my life. And that's one of the things that I do with every sponsee, is we go through all three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps, the traditions, and the concepts. There are jewels in all of this, and I want them to have the best of everything we have to offer. They talked to me about the traditions. They said, those aren't just for the group. You are a member of a group. You need to be an informed member. You need to learn how to apply those in that group, in the world around you, because you're going to start needing to know how to put those in your personal life. And when I began to do that, I began to have different relationships with people. And it wasn't the all about me show. And that's enabled me to be more a part of everything instead of apart from. And so the traditions are such gems to be used in all of my affairs. They talk to me about service. Service to me is always the kind of thing that's inconvenient. The stuff that you do outside of the home group level and the convenient level. I think probably one of my favorite stories to talk about is on myself is that there was a few years ago I was invited to talk at a 6:30 a.m. meeting. Now that may not be early for you, but I assure you that is really early for me. Because I don't wake up and look like this, okay? This takes scheduling and planning and focus. I mean, you got to focus putting this all together, right? I don't wear baseball caps and flip-flops, you know, to meetings ever. So, you know, I go like this. So I'm thinking, does he know how early this is? You know, what this, I mean, I said yes, but my mind starts thinking, right? So as the day keeps approaching, I know I'm not going to not go, but I'm still trying to think of a way to get out of it. And I'm back and forth, and you know, that flip-flop. So finally, it's almost, now this is me talking within myself. I said, okay, hold on here now. Okay, so you're saying that you've got invited to share your story to anybody who wants to listen, and it's at 6:30 a.m., and you think that's a little too tiring. I mean, that's a little too early for you. Yes, that's correct. Well, why don't we flip this over and ask yourself, now, if they had said that's where the booze and the boys were, was 6:30 a.m. at this location, would that have been inconvenient? Oh, God, no, I'd have been there at 6 o'clock. Where are they? You know, right? It made me realize again that for drinking and dying, I never gave a pause. I never gave a second thought to what was asked, what was requested, where I needed to go, how inconvenient, how far, how much, what needed to get done to get it done. And yet I'll hem and haw, think about it. Does it fit in my schedule? I want the same commitment to my recovery that I gave to drinking and dying. And this is what service is to me. This is where I get that extra, you know, vitamin B of spiritual, you know, daily whatever. And then the other thing was carry the message. So I've got a few minutes left here to share a couple of things. And, you know, I started in Minneapolis, and I was sober there 4 years, and I was just on fire. I felt so in the middle with the sunlight of the Spirit. And I moved to Atlanta when I was just shy of 4 years. I took that four-year birthday cake, and I don't know, something clicked inside of my head that said I knew something. And I decided to take that down from 7 meetings a week to 2 or 3, which quickly became 2. And over the next couple years, it got shorter and shorter, my involvement. I never stopped going to AA, and I had a sponsor, I had a home group, but it was, you know, a wave across the room kind of sponsorship that I was doing, and it got smaller and smaller, and at 6 years sober, I felt like I'd gone from the sunlight of the Spirit to a corner of a dark alley and wondered why. And I took that 6-year cake, and I came up with a plan that people, places, and things are going to make me happy. Now, the real terminology is called men, money, and mansions are going to make me happy, okay? So, I'm on a mission, and I met a couple little fellas. They had what I was looking for. I knew I'd come to love them, I'm sure. You know, that was secondary. And gratefully, both of these little guys married somebody else, right? So, at 6.9 years of sobriety, I came crashing back down into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when I came in February of 1976, I surrendered to the active alcoholism of the substances. And here at 6 years and 9 months of sobriety, I'm surrendering to the ongoing illness. I haven't taken a drink, but I'm as sick as I ever want to be without ever again. I was so far from that sunlight of the Spirit, and I recommitted myself. I was at that proverbial fork in the road. You either continue on to the bitter end or accept spiritual help, which for me was recommit to Alcoholics Anonymous 110%. And that really is when I feel like I really took the steps, even though I'd taken them before. It was like they had a, like they were written all over and brand new again. I would move to Southern California. That marriage would come to an end. I would eventually move to Northern California because I got married. My husband's an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's 27 years sober. I'm 40, just so you get that part of it, you know. I am the long timer. I never use it unless I need to. He is such an awesome member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's my great inspiration. We love walking this path together. And I'm 26 years sober at the time, and we're celebrating our one-year anniversary, and we're back in Atlanta where I had lived, and this was the last of the important things he needed to see in my life. And we go over to my old home group. It was great fun. And the next day we went to a luncheon with a bunch of mixed people. And when we sat down for lunch, there was pre-poured wine at the table. Now, I've been around alcohol. I mean, we choose not to have it in our home. I don't go hanging out in bars, but I've certainly been around it. I know how to say no, turn glasses over. I don't need to recite chapter 3 or anything like that. You know, nobody really cares usually. Having it pre-poured really threw me off a little bit that day. So I just kind of moved it out of my way. And little did I know that that particular event, now I am in the middle of you guys for 19 years. I look at that 7-year mark, 19 years have gone by, I'm 26. I'm in the middle of you, and that particular event would flip a switch in me that for the next 6 months, I had a craving for drunkenness. Now, not a craving to drink, but a craving to be blotto, drunk, can't get off the floor kind of drunk. It was like a chemical imbalance is about the best I can describe it. And it was just this craving right here, not a mental obsession. And it just circled for 6 months like a buzzard waiting for me to make a mistake. This kind of feeling. And it was crazy. I'd never heard anybody talk about that. I didn't even know how to talk about it to people. And I just started analyzing everything. What am I doing wrong to make this even happen to me? And there wasn't anything. I wasn't like I had slowed down on meetings, prayers, relationships, sponsors, service commitments, anything. It was still as big and vital. It was never a checklist. It was still vibrant, and I didn't know what was going on. About 6 months into this, and I was in a meeting one morning, I felt fine, and when I left, I was gripped with the terror that I would drink against my will. Kind of go into a trance, like a Stepford type of thing, right? And I called my sponsor, one of the many great reasons to have a sponsor, and I dial her longhand, so my phone is never dead without her number, right? It's emblazoned in my head. And she listened to what I said, and I was so scared. And she said, honey, what we have is alcoholism, not alcoholism. And it wasn't anything new, but it was something that was just this whitewash of a veil kind of gotten lifted. And what happened is that two things came into my mind, is that step 10 in our big book says that we have a daily reprieve, not a weekly reprieve. Not a monthly, not an every AA birthday reprieve. I get the reprieve every morning when I wake up and I ask God to help me stay sober today as I did today. And with some prayer and meditation, I spend that time with God. And tonight I'll do the same thing I did last night, which was thank Him for another sober day. And then tomorrow morning I'm doing the same thing I did this morning, which is ask Him to help me stay sober today. So I've always looked at this as a one day at a time thing. And this is the day that counts. This is the day I show up for life in every area I possibly can. And so it reminded me that I just get this daily reprieve. But the other thing it reminded me of was in chapter 3 when it talks about that we are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period of time, it gets worse, never better. And I looked at that new again, and I believe totally that I am in the grip of a progressive illness. It clearly showed itself to me. Well, that be the case, then I had always better be in the action of a progressive recovery. I've got to be in front of that, because no car ever rolls uphill when they're coasting. It always rolls down, and I don't want to wake up that tiger. When you see that tail start flipping around, you better start paying attention. You know what I mean? And so this is the day that counts. This is the day that I've shown up for life, for service, and to have my opportunity to share my experience with you. Thank you. Thank you.